We had more of a somewhat traditional debate last night in the Veep Stakes, but it was also a historic one. Today on The Takeaway for Thursday, October 8th, we're talking about how the media is handling this moment for Senator Kamala Harris. Plus, as November 3rd nears, LGBTQ issues are a major dividing point before the two candidates.
GLAAD has totaled 181 attacks that they say this administration has taken against the LGBTQ community.
And a deep look at Native issues in the Supreme Court and the election. We asked what's important to you if you're a Native American voter.
My people are the Penobscot from Maine. I would like to see them get better medical care, and I would like reparations from the United States government. People don't realize that 100 million of us were slaughtered.
But first,
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking. I'm speaking.
The important is you said the truth.
If you don't mind letting me finish, we can then have a conversation, okay?
Please.
Okay. The American people have witnessed what is the greatest failure of any presidential administration in the history of our country.
When you say what the American people have done over these last 8 months hasn't worked, that's a great disservice to the sacrifices the American people have made.
We will not let anyone subvert our democracy.
Senator, your party has spent the last 3.5 years trying to overturn the results of the last election.
The president's trade war with China. You lost that trade war. You lost it.
Lost the trade war with China. Joe Biden never fought it. Are you and Joe Biden, if somehow you win this election, going to pack the Supreme Court to get your way?
He interrupted me, and I'd like to just finish, please. If you have a pre-existing condition, heart disease, diabetes, breast cancer, they're coming for you.
Last night's vice presidential debate between Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Mike Pence was a more subdued event than what Americans witnessed last week between the two presidential candidates. But it was still anything but normal. The two candidates were separated by plexiglass barriers to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, which has killed more than 210,000 Americans and infected President Trump and many of his aides and employees. But the event was also historic. Senator Harris was the first Black woman and woman of color to sit on the debate stage. How the media has covered last night's debate and Senator Harris herself is where we begin today on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Joining me now is Kimberly Pierler Allen, a visiting practitioner at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Kimberly, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So we've talked a little bit about on this show about how the media, quote unquote, the media has covered Kamala Harris so far. What's your assessment?
I think so far the results have definitely been mixed. I think there has been an attempt to really cover the historic nature of her nomination as vice president. But then there is also, I think, particularly on social media, the attempts to undermine and discredit her credentials, disinformation about her record, and the unfortunate double bind that continues to plague women candidates overall about whether or not she is likable, she is aggressive, is she tough enough, does she even know what she's talking about, despite having a record and credentials that she does. So I think it's definitely been mixed. I think the misogyny, racism, and sexism that are that we knew were coming have been absolutely on full display, but there has definitely been more of an effort to push back on that narrative. We'll see how effective it has been, but it's been mixed, unfortunately. And like I said, we knew it was coming, that they were going to come after her in ways that they wouldn't come after a white man.
I want to give two specific thoughts on that, because I agree with you 100% on the likability question. I mean, women across the board face that issue, right? Particularly women in positions of power. They have to walk this narrow line between being strong and being likable. There was a moment last night in the debate, Kimberly, that stood out to me as an example of Harris having to do that. And it was when Susan Page, the moderator, referred to Kamala Harris as her name, Kamala Harris. And then quickly sort of backtracked and said, you know, vice presidential candidate. Or, and Kamala said, no, it's okay, you know, Kamala. And I thought that I've been in that position as a woman of color. It felt like she was trying to show that it's okay, but really, was it okay? I mean, it just felt like, would the moderator have referred to Vice President Pence as Mike, for example? And would Mike have had to, you know, sort of say, oh, that's okay, don't worry.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, she is a U.S. senator. She is a sitting U.S. senator. And never once during the debate did Susan Page slip and call Vice President Pence Mike. And there is always that deference that women in general and women of color in particular have to convey of like, you know, you slighted me, but it's all right. You know, I'm not going to hold it against you, because there is that underlying premise of like, really, I'm not supposed to be here because this is a man's world. So if you want to, I will overlook any transgressions in this space because I'm just grateful to be on this stage. And I think there is, you know, we have a lot of deprogramming to do, you know, all the way around about what is an appropriate role for a woman. And we've seen by Kamala Harris's debate performance last night that the senator is absolutely prepared and capable of being the vice president of the United States. So there is no reason for her to say, oh, you know, it's okay that you didn't give me my proper due as a sitting U.S. senator, but because I'm just grateful to be here. So there's a lot of, you know, both on the behalf of the moderator and on behalf of Senator Harris, you know, a lot of work that needs to be done there, deprogramming that psychology.
There's also the question, and this was something that was raised in the New York Times' analysis of the debate, where, to your earlier point, Kimberly, women, Black women and women of color more broadly, in many instances, are forced to sort of, you know, prove that they deserve to be on that stage or in that chair. And in one instance, I believe Senator Harris noted her experience as a former prosecutor and as a U.S. senator, and sort of having to recite the resume, if you will, to sort of prove that she deserves to be in that spot. Did you take that away as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There was a, I think throughout the debate, she had to constantly remind people about why she is qualified to be there, whether it was her going through her record more than once, to her command of history and understanding of civics that she had to convey during the debate. She was constantly having to prove that she was qualified to be there, in addition to making the policy points and attacks that she had wanted to do. She had that additional layer of saying, I'm qualified to ask these questions because, and then here's my question. So I think it was, you know, she had quite a weight on her shoulders of things that she had to convey during this debate.
I know many Black women and women of color more broadly had probably felt that moment. In particular, Kimberly, how do you think the media covered Senator Harris after the debate?
Well, I think there was definitely a lot of, you know, it was on full display what women in general have had to deal with day in and day out in terms of being talked over, you know, her line repeatedly, I'm speaking, you know, if you would, you know, let me finish, we can have a conversation. This is something that women every day encounter when, you know, they're in meetings with men or in discussions, that they are constantly talked over and cut off. So I think that was something that was definitely highlighted in the coverage. I think it following the debate, you know, I think the initial results were pretty positive of her performance and in terms of her ability to carry the water of the ticket overall. And I think, you know, from that perspective, that was great. You know, I'm looking to see, you know, on the long term over the next few days, or actually probably the next few hours, how her responses get picked apart. I think there were many times when in the coverage, people have really pointed to the double standard of the debate, where the vice president didn't answer directly really any of the questions, where Senator Harris, she answered most of them, or at least touched on them, where Vice President Pence, you know, pivoted completely away from a topic to talk about something else. And at the end of the day, he hammered on home on the point that she did not answer the question about the Supreme Court, where he didn't answer any of the other questions. So I think there's also the question, you know, around the moderation of the debate as to whether or not these moderators should push back and say, but you didn't answer this question. And I think there's it's a lot on the opponent in the debate to be able to convey their points as well as hold, you know, hold their opponent accountable as to whether or not they've answered questions.
Kimberly, one thing that's been interesting so far is how the media, again, this sort of big conglomerate of quote unquote the media, or at least the mainstream media in this instance, has covered Senator Harris's identity, both as a Black woman and as a woman, as an Indian woman, as the child of immigrants. Were there moments last night that you thought Senator Harris was able to lean in to that part of her identity? And did she need to do that?
I think what she, I think very astutely did last night was without saying, you know, this is my experience as a woman of color in America, she was able to speak about that experience when she talked about the effects of the economy and the, you know, her lines about, you know, how panicked were you when you were looking for toilet paper and how panicked were you when you were afraid that, where you couldn't see your parents because you're afraid that your children were going to kill them, and you know, talking about criminal justice reform and the Breonna Taylor case, she was able to pull on those threads without having to name, because I am a woman of color, I think this. And I think it, she was very astute at pulling in the life experience that I think really resonated. And there were definitely moments, particularly in her body language, and I saw posts on Twitter about, particularly when she was saying, well, I'm speaking, and, you know, I was even sitting with my daughter, and she said, well, the next thing that comes is you start speaking through clenched teeth as a Black mother. And, you know, there were definitely a lot of things that were conveyed without having to specifically say it that I think, you know, the American public saw and really resonated with them.
I wonder if you could help us, give us a little bit of a historical backdrop for this as well, because I remember, and I'm dating myself here, but I remember Geraldine Ferraro running for vice president back in the 1980s. I remember Sarah Palin running for vice president. Those so far have been the only two women who have run on a national vice presidential ticket who have been on that same stage as Senator Harris was yesterday. Were there any unique differences, Kimberly, that you saw in how both of those candidates, Palin and Ferraro, dealt with the debate that maybe mirrored or were different from what Senator Harris dealt with?
Well, I think there was, you know, Geraldine Ferraro had the huge weight of being the first and having to stand on that stage and defend and represent all women for the first time in our nation's history. I think that I think is probably most comparable to Senator Harris's experience last night of being the first woman of color to stand on that stage and you know, all that representation means and carries with it. And, you know, similar to, and I think Sarah Palin also experienced some of that as the first Republican woman to stand on that stage. And, you know, I think they each in their own way, but I would definitely say Geraldine Ferraro as the first woman and Senator Harris as the first woman of color, they were carrying the full population of their identity onto that stage and had the weight of saying, of proving that women and women of color are acceptable, that they are capable and can and should be able to lead at this level. So I think there was just that added weight. And I think also that added excitement from that both of them and also Sarah Palin as well experienced, because this was something that we don't see often. You know, we seem to be seeing it more. I mean, it was 1984 when Geraldine Ferraro was the VP, and then we had to wait until 2008, and then here we are in 2020, you know, in a much shorter time span of getting another woman on the vice presidential stage, and we had Hillary Clinton in between at the top of the ticket. So the changes are coming more frequently. So I think the energy will change, but there's still that very strong and important message of like representation matters, and that we can and should operate at this level. And this is what happens when we, you know, work to really level the playing field so that all of our candidates, regardless of their gender, regardless of their ethnicity, are able to show their full set of capabilities.
Kimberly Peeler Allen is a visiting practitioner at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers. Kimberly, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, we're going to be talking more about last night's vice presidential debate, but we also have some breaking news. The Commission on Presidential Debates had announced that the next presidential debate would be virtual for safety reasons, but President Trump has told Fox Business News that he would not participate. Joe Biden, meanwhile, says that he's all in. Joining me now is my colleague Amy Walter, the host of Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway and the national editor of the Cook Political Report. Amy, hello.
Hey, Tanzina.
Let's start with some of the news, because last week we talked about the presidential debate and the potential for not having any future debates and what that could do to our democracy. But Amy, the president, at least as of right now, is saying that he is not going to participate in the next debate. So now what?
So now we're to the place where we kind of maybe thought we were always going to be, which is with one presidential debate as the one we saw as the final one, and the rest of the campaign basically with the president trying to play on turf where he's much more comfortable. He likes his rallies. He likes being able to call in to cable news shows. He likes being able to give uninterrupted press conferences in the Rose Garden. That's where you'll see him. That's where he's much more comfortable. The irony, Tanzina, is, you know, the debate actually is one place where the president could finally, at least if not flip the script completely, at least turn the page a little bit, force Joe Biden to answer questions that he's not particularly comfortable in answering about his agenda, about certain issues, or just let him speak enough so that the focus of the campaign and the focus of the next few days on the trail are on Joe Biden and maybe some of his shortcomings and his inconsistencies rather than completely about Donald Trump. But President Trump has to be not just in every news story, he has to dominate every single minute of every news cycle. And as such, we are where we are.
We are where we are. And I wonder what that means. I mean, this is a developing story, so we'll see whether or not the president remains out of this virtual debate. We know that he has a tendency to change his mind on things pretty quickly, at least on Twitter. But Amy, does that open the possibility for Joe Biden to just, he says he's still in, to just be on that stage by himself?
Right, and just have a sort of town hall style meeting, because this is a town hall debate, right?
Correct.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting, I did see that one of the commissioners on the presidential debate board tweeted out, you know, it is there's an ability for any of the candidates to say no. If they want to say no, they can say no. He noted that the last person to say no to one of the debates that was offered by the Presidential Commission on Debates was Jimmy Carter, which was not, as the kids might say, that's a pretty good subtweet.
right.
Noting, you know, if you want to join Jimmy Carter as the only president to not do this, you go right ahead. How'd that end up for him?
That's a pretty hard subtweet right there for the president. But I'm curious, just to not forget that we had a vice presidential debate last night. We talked a lot about Chris Wallace's performance in last week's debate, if we could even call it that. But Susan Page from USA Today was the moderator last night. At one point, she called Kamala Harris Kamala by her first name. I think she did an okay job, but I also think she was in the position to have to reiterate the rules and the time limits a few times. And New York Times says that both candidates got equal time, but I'm wondering, what was your assessment on how Susan Page did as moderator for that event?
You know, it's interesting that the term is moderator, right? And only because it suggests that their job is simply to enforce the rules, right? You get 2 minutes, you get 2 minutes, I've given you your time, right? Sort of play traffic cop, rather than to push the candidates to answer some of the questions. Notably, you know, she asked a very good question last night to both of them. You know, they are both running mates to men in their 70s, one of whom has contracted a deadly virus. And she said, have you had a conversation with your boss about safeguards or procedures when it comes to the issue of presidential disability? Now, it's an uncomfortable question. I can understand why neither of them wanted to answer that. But when they both dodged it, she should have the imperative to say, you know what? I'm not going to let you get away with that. Or on so many of the other questions where they just went initially just right into talking points, or basically said, thanks for that question, I'm going to answer something completely different. And so I think it's gotten caught into this. We have to have these buckets, right, of issues that we have to make sure we have to touch China, and we have to touch issues about the Supreme Court and coronavirus. All of that's important. But at the end of the day, I think what voters would really like to see is somebody who has knowledge, who has the background, to be able to say, you know what, Mr. Vice President, that's not what your administration has actually done. You know what, Senator Harris, you actually did say something else, or you did vote a different way than what you're saying right now. And have that, to me, that would be much more helpful. And I think for voters as well. And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, if you think that would be a better use of our time.
I think that would be journalism, Amy, that you're describing there, that so many of us appreciate. And I think you're right. I think the American public would benefit from some actual answers. I think a lot of these debates have really turned into that. And in some ways, both candidates did their job by just promoting what their presidential running mates are doing. But it really remains to be seen if this format needs even further restructuring.
Right. And that we push that on maybe the next one. Tanzina, you can do it.
Yeah, we'll do it together. Amy Walter is the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway on weekends and national editor of The Cook Political Report. Amy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tanzina.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
C'est Since taking office, President Donald Trump has chipped away at the rights of the LGBTQ community in the United States, from barring transgender people from openly serving in the military to preventing U.S. embassies from flying pride flags. The president has also appointed more than 200 conservative judges and just announced conservative judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Joe Biden and his running mate Kamala Harris have been dubbed, quote, the most pro-equality ticket in history by LGBTQ activists like Alfonso David, who run Human Rights Campaign, one of the biggest LGBTQ advocacy groups. And though Biden has promised to try and undo Trump's damage to the LGBTQ community, it's not going to be easy. Joining me now is Kate Sawson, an LGBTQ plus reporter at The 19th. Kate, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We mentioned a bunch of changes to policy that the Trump administration has taken that many say are anti-LGBTQ. Are there any others that stand out?
You know, GLAAD has totaled 181 attacks that they say this administration has taken against the LGBTQ community. So you can kind of go on for quite some time. On day one, the Trump administration removed mentions of LGBTQ people on the White House website. The administration flat-funded HIV work globally, which had a bad impact on the pandemic, actually, for all of us, because it meant that these centers all over the world were less prepared to deal with the pandemic. And he has pushed to allow shelters to turn away transgender people who are already disproportionately homeless. And that's the big issue that's happening right now. So the list really goes on, but those are some big ones. And then, of course, removing anti-discrimination protections that protect trans people in the Affordable Care Act has been really big for the community.
We mentioned also, Kate, the federal judiciary, which the president has been very successful and has made a key point of his administration. He's appointed more than 200 judges at that level. What has that meant for the LGBTQ community?
Yes, this is something that, you know, it seems like Republicans have historically really focused on, and progressive people, especially in the LGBTQ community, have been sort of less focused on. In appointing these judges, there's going to be generations of conservative calls. And of course, the Supreme Court is going to be the biggest one. Amy Coney Barrett served as faculty of the Alliance for Defending Freedom's Blackstone Legal Fellowship. And so for those who don't know, the Alliance for Defending Freedom has been labeled as a hate group by several organizations. And they have fought for the criminalization of homosexuality abroad in places like Jamaica, Belize. They have worked for the sterilization of trans people in European governments in order to update their IDs. They equate LGBT people with pedophiles. And a lot of these judges that we've seen appointed actually have ties with these vehemently anti-LGBTQ organizations. And so when these issues come to the bench that deal with LGBTQ rights, that's a scary prospect for a lot of LGBTQ people and LGBTQ legal advocates. That's not something that will be undone in the next year or 4 years should we see a Biden presidency.
Kate, let's talk about Joe Biden. He's been vocal about making LGBTQ issues a priority in the White House if elected. But what has his record been on these issues, particularly when he was vice president under President Obama?
Yeah, Joe Biden has been held up sort of as a champion of LGBTQ equality, especially by older generations, right? Because in 2012, he came out for marriage equality sort of in a surprise way. And him doing that forced President Obama shortly thereafter to come out for marriage equality. And that was seen as a moment that forced the country to grapple with this. And it felt like a snowball effect after that. We saw the Defense of Marriage Act overturn, and then we saw the legalization of marriage nationwide. And so he has been held up as a champion. And at the same time, he sort of stumbled over, you know, trans issues and sometimes keeping up with more nuanced words, right? And so a lot of people, I think, on the more progressive left wanted to see a more progressive pick with Joe Biden, maybe not being that. But at the same time, I think LGBTQ people, by and large, are going to fall all over themselves to vote for Biden, for Harris on these issues. He has a full platform on LGBTQ issues, and it deals with things in a holistic way, right? So right now we have a crisis of violence against transgender women, and the Biden platform deals with the fact that, by and large, trans people face really serious unemployment discrimination, lack of housing, and that those are things that put trans people right in the way of violence.
The former vice president is also supporting something called the Equality Act. What would that do?
Yeah, the Equality Act is something that just about every Democrat who jumped into the race in 2020 supported. So the Equality Act would enshrine civil rights protections into the Civil Rights Act of 1964, meaning that in public accommodations, in employment protections, in all ways of life, it would become illegal to discriminate against LGBTQ people. And as we saw, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that you can't fire LGBTQ people just because they're LGBTQ. With the Supreme Court that we have coming up, though, there might be carve-outs to that, which means that, you know, if you have a religious objection to following that law, the Supreme Court might make an exception for you, which means that that law doesn't really mean very much, right? If you can claim an exception, the law doesn't really hold. And so a lot of people have said, we really need the Equality Act. Congress needs to do this. And it extends those protections because in most states, it's still legal to fire someone if they are LGBTQ.
Amy Coney Barrett has officially been nominated to fill the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat on the Supreme Court. What do we know about how she would rule on cases involving LGBTQ rights? Does anything point to her judicial past to explain that? Does it, anything can give us a sense of how she might land on some of these issues?
Yeah. Amy Coney Barrett is, of course, you know, seen as a conservative justice, and she has stated that she does have certain personal beliefs, that those personal beliefs should never come into the way that she would rule, right? And that's an important thing to note. It's also important to note, though, that past Supreme Court nominees have also said the same thing and then ruled in ways that align with the Alliance for Defending Freedom. One of the things that is most alarming to a lot of LGBTQ people is that Amy Coney Barrett has given talks that refer to transgender women as men, and that she believes that it would strain the text of the law to allow transgender people to use bathrooms that align with their gender in public.
Kate Sawson is the LGBTQ plus reporter at The 19th. Kate, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
This summer, the Supreme Court sided with Native groups in ruling that the United States must recognize the eastern half of Oklahoma as tribal territory. Now, around one quarter of the state's recent oil and gas wells are situated on tribal land. And that's left Oklahoma's oil and gas producers scrambling to respond to the decision. But last week, the industry was handed a much-needed reprieve when the Environmental Protection Agency gave the state of Oklahoma more authority to regulate tribal lands. For more on what the EPA's decision will mean, I'm going to talk to Rebecca Nagel, citizen of the Cherokee Nation, journalist and host of the podcast This Land. Rebecca, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what exactly did the EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler decide in terms of giving Oklahoma, the state of Oklahoma, more authority over the environment and these lands in particular?
Yeah, So to understand what happened this week, we actually have to go all the way back to 2005. So in that year, a senator from Oklahoma, Senator Inhofe, attached a rider to a very long and mostly in the weeds transportation bill. And it was just, you know, a couple sentences that gave the state of Oklahoma regulatory authority over reservations within the state if it so asked for. And so this had not been enacted. It had sat dormant for 15 years. And then on July 9th, the Supreme Court ruled that Congress had never disestablished the reservation of Muscogee Creek Nation. And even though the state of Oklahoma had not recognized that reservation for over a century, that it was still legally Indian land. And so, you know, I think one thing it's really, really important for a lot of folks to realize is that tribal jurisdiction, including civil jurisdiction, which regulatory authority falls under, is already extremely limited by the Supreme Court. And so a lot of the fears that we saw from oil and gas during this case were quite overblown. And also, I just think dishonest, you know, during the court proceedings, oil and gas, you know, we're sort of running around like Chicken Little saying if Muscogee Creek Nation wins, the sky is going to fall down, knowing full well the whole time that they had this rider in their back pocket, you know, and unfortunately, because we have a very pro-oil state and a pro-oil EPA, it didn't take long for them to get it enacted.
I want to play a clip here from Oklahoma Governor Stitt, who first requested environmental control from the EPA back in July.
I want tribes to be very successful, but not at the expense of non-tribal businesses. And I believe over the long haul, if we don't have a level playing field, if we don't understand what the rules are, we will not have non-tribal businesses growing and establishing and coming and expanding in eastern Oklahoma.
Rebecca, why is Stitt or Governor Stitt so concerned about, is there a non-level playing field right now? And if there is, I would imagine it tilts in favor of non-tribal businesses, not the other way around.
Exactly. So tribal jurisdiction is extremely complicated on reservations, but to summarize, tribes have very, very little regulatory authority over non-native businesses because of a series of court decisions that came out in the early 80s. And what we see happen over and over and over again in Indian country is that this fear, and I think we really have to call it overblown white panic. And I think we also have to talk about it as being racist, as this idea that tribal governments are inferior and would do a worse job of having regulatory authority than the state of Oklahoma that has deregulated fracking to the point that now in Oklahoma we have man-made earthquakes, right? And within that, because of the way the Supreme Court has already limited tribal jurisdiction, we see over and over again, you know, tribes actually trying to, you know, prevent non-native corporations from polluting their lands, prevent non-native corporations from dumping toxic waste and from, you know, mining uranium and things like that. And very, very often, those corporations get away with it anyways. You know, Oklahoma is the site of one of the biggest Superfund sites right now that the EPA is still failing to adequately clean up. You know, here in northeastern Oklahoma on Quapaw land, there are chat piles from lead and zinc mining that are so large you can see them from Google Earth, you know? And this is what, you know, it mostly fell on the BIA. But there's a long history of even where tribal reservations and regulatory authority is recognized, non-native corporations getting away with behavior like that. And so this idea that tribes having jurisdiction would cause chaos, would wreak havoc, is the same argument Oklahoma has been making throughout the many years history of this case. I think what we need to do is that Congress needs to fix that rider. So Congress has the authority to reverse what Inhofe snuck in a very undemocratic process without the consultation or knowledge of tribes or really anybody else from Oklahoma. And so, you know, we need to talk about fixing that.
I'm speaking with journalist Rebecca Nagel about a recent EPA decision to give the state of Oklahoma authority over many environmental issues on tribal lands. But that's just one of the issues on the minds of many Native voters this year. Here's what some of those listeners had to say.
My name's Casey from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I would love to see any politicians really recognize First Nations existence and issues and have it part of their platform.
My name is Linda Little Bear, and I live in Hopewell, New Jersey. My people are the Penobscot from Maine. I would like to see them get better medical care, and I would like reparations from the United States government. People don't realize that 100 million of us were slaughtered, 100 million. And to be honest, I hold out near no hope that your government will help us.
You can keep calling us to tell us your thoughts on that at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. And I'm joined again now by Rebecca Nagel. Thanks for staying on the line with me, Rebecca.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we heard a couple of calls up there, and I'm wondering, you know, as far as what you're hearing from our callers, does that sort of align with what you're hearing from people, from Native voters heading into this election?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's important to underscore is that Indian Country is an incredibly diverse place. There are over 570 federally recognized tribes in the United States. We're in different states, different regions. We have different cultures and histories and language. And even within our own tribes, if one thing is true about Native people, we have a lot of different viewpoints. But I do think that within that, the coronavirus pandemic has hit tribes and hit Indian Country really hard and is absolutely an issue that people are focused on. You know, we are still seeing tribes and Indian health services and urban Indian health centers struggle to get basic needs, basic supplies, and with a second relief or a third relief package now being stalled for over 100 days, I think a lot of tribes are really looking for leadership at the national level that will bring that needed relief.
Rebecca, of course, we know we continue to battle the coronavirus in this country. We also know that communities of color have been disproportionately affected. That includes Native communities. Where does that stand for this population as we head into really the fall and the winter as far as an election issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is absolutely an election issue. And I think oftentimes the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on Native Americans is left out of the national conversation, whether it's the media coverage, the policy discussion, and we're finding that it's even happening in the data collection itself. So in a lot of counties and states are categorizing Native COVID patients as other instead of actually capturing the data.
Is that typical?
Yes, it's actually very common. There are some studies that have shown that up to half of Native patients are miscategorized as the wrong race in hospital records. And we see that even on vital records. So one study, and vital records are things like birth and death certificates. In one study, they found that about a third of people are miscategorized on their vital records. And so when we think about how coronavirus is impacting Indian Country, we know that it is having a disproportionate impact. And then we are also experiencing a second crisis where we're being erased from the data. And that informs policy conversations. It informs the allocation of resources. So it's something that absolutely needs to be addressed.
So far, we're a little less than a month away from the presidential election. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from, if anything, from Joe Biden's campaign and Kamala Harris's campaign about Native issues that's interesting or promising or not?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, Biden does have a platform for native issues. I would love to see it be more specific. I think during the primary, we saw a few platforms that really got into the weeds of policy that for me personally, I think every Democratic leader is going to say things like upholding the treaty and trust responsibility with tribes, living up to the promise that the United States has made to our tribes, respecting tribal sovereignty. But I think where the rubber really hits the road is what policy measures does that actually mean? And I would love to see a platform that's more specific to that.
One thing that has been addressed, at least, and we've talked about this extensively here on The Takeaway, is the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in this country and beyond. We know that Savannah's Law was something that was just passed and had bipartisan support. What else needs to be done, Rebecca, in this particular issue as we head into this election?
Yeah. And so I think that Savannah's Act is a historic win. And we also have to recognize that it does kind of the bare minimum. You know, it's just going in and doing things like helping law enforcement collect good data and have actually the proper response when a Native woman goes missing and murdered, which is something that women who are white don't have to worry about, right? And what Native advocates have been calling for years is a full restoration of tribal jurisdiction. So right now, if you are non-Native and you go onto a reservation and you commit rape, you commit murder, you kidnap somebody, you abuse a child, the tribe is actually prohibited from prosecuting you because you are not Native. And while violent crime has dropped across the country in recent decades, it has skyrocketed in Indian country because of this jurisdictional loophole that was created by the Supreme Court. And so what we need to see Congress and the next administration do is go in and fix that. We have known for years that that is the main part of the answer to keeping Native women and children safe. And so we just need the political will to get it done.
One of the things that's come up also among the long list of issues that affect Native communities is representation. And as you mentioned earlier, data collection, the U.S. Census, but really also looking at voter suppression. What are some of the main issues that you're seeing with voter suppression?
You know, there was a really famous issue that came up in the midterms where Republicans were trying to defeat Heidi Heitkamp. They required that your ID that you use to vote in North Dakota could not have a P.O. box. It had to have a physical street address. And because many folks who live on reservations live in more remote areas that may not even have a street number, you know, use P.O. boxes. And so, you know, we've seen things like that. There has been, you know, there was a very famous gerrymandering case that happened in Utah, where actually the Navajo Nation was able to use the Voting Rights Act to start a lawsuit about the representation on a county executive board there. And the way it tied to national issues that people might hear about is the Bears Ears National Monument. And so when President Trump said that he was upholding the wish of the local government to diminish that monument, it was actually the local representation misrepresented the many Native people who lived in that area because of the way that the area had been gerrymandered.
Rebecca Nagel is a journalist and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and she also hosts the podcast This Land. Rebecca, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
And let's remind our listeners that Rebecca was also on a panel for First People's Week here at WNYC's The Green Space, and you can find the recording for that at firstpeoplesweek.org. That's it for me this week. Amy Walter is in with you as always on Friday. But before I go, I want to give a quick shout out to the fabulous team that makes this show. Our board operator this week was Debbie Daughtry. Our directors and sound designers were Vince Fairchild and Jay Cowett. Jackie Martin is our line producer. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. And the Takeaway's producers are Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Asher Stockler. Polly Arungu and Dina Syed Ahmed were our digital editors this week. week. David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is the executive producer of The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.